Welcome to Nightfall Narratives with Oxford Public Library. We will be bringing you some of the strange and unusual narratives from the public domain once a week. You can download the audio and listen at your convenience from our website, www.oxfordpl.org, or you can follow us on social media. Now, let's get started. Don't get scared now. The House and the Brain by Lord Edward Bulwer Lytton. A friend of mine said to me one day, "Since we last met, I have discovered a haunted house in the midst of London." "Really? Haunted?" "Well, all I know is this. 6 weeks ago, my wife and I were in search of a furnished apartment. Passing a quiet street, we saw on the window of one of the houses a bill, 'Apartments Furnished.' We entered the house, liked the rooms, engaged them by the week, and left them the third day. No power on earth could have reconciled my wife to stay longer." "What did you see?" "I have no desire to be ridiculed as a superstitious dreamer. Nor, on the other hand, could I ask you to accept on my affirmation what you would hold to be incredible without evidence of your own senses. Let me only say this. It was not so much what we saw or heard that drove us away, as it was an undefinable terror which seized both of us whenever we passed by the door of a certain unfurnished room. And the strangest marvel of all was that for once in my life I agreed with my wife and allowed that it was impossible to stay a fourth night in that house. Accordingly, I summoned the woman who kept the house and attended on us, and told her that the rooms did not quite suit us, and we would not stay out our week. She said dryly, 'I know why. You have stayed longer than any other lodger. Few have stayed a second night, none before you a third, but I take it they have been very kind to you.' 'They who?' I asked. 'Why, they who haunt the house. I don't mind them. I remember them many years ago when I lived in this house. Not as a servant, but I know they will be the death of me some day. I don't care, I am old and must die soon anyhow. And then I shall be with them, and in this house still.'" The woman spoke with so dreary a calmness that really it was a sort of awe that prevented my conversing with her further. I paid for my week, and too happy were my wife and I to get off so cheaply. "You excite my curiosity," said I. "Give me the address." And when we parted, I walked straight toward the house thus indicated. It is situated on the north side of Oxford Street in a dull but respectable thoroughfare. I found the house shut up, no bill at the window, and no response to my knock. As I was turning away, a beer boy collecting pewter pots at the neighbor's areas said to me, "Do you want anyone at that house, sir?" "Yes, I heard it was to be let." "Let? Why, the woman who kept it is dead, and has been these 3 weeks, and no one can be found to stay there, though Mr. J. offered ever so much. He offered mother, who charges for him £1 a week, just to open and shut the windows, and she would not." "Would not? And why?" "The house is haunted, and the old woman who kept it was found dead in her bed, with her eyes wide open, and they say the devil strangled her." "Pooh! You speak of Mr. J. Is he the owner of the house?" "Yes." "Where does he live? In G Street?" I gave the pot boy the gratuity he earned by his liberal information, and proceeded to Mr. J. in the G Street, which was close by the street that boasted the haunted house. I was lucky enough to find Mr. J. at home, an elderly man with an intelligent countenance and prepossessing manners. I communicated my name and my business frankly. I said I heard the house was considered to be haunted, and that I had a strong desire to examine a house with so equivocal a reputation, that I should be greatly obliged if he would allow me to hire it, though only for a night. I was willing to pay for that privilege whatever he might incline to ask. "Sir," said Mr. J., with great courtesy, "the house is at your service for as short or as long a time as you please. Rent is out of the question. The obligation will be on my side should you be able to discover the cause of the strange phenomena which at present deprive it of all value. I cannot let it, for I cannot even get a servant to keep it in order or answer the door. Unluckily, the house is haunted, if I may use that expression, not only by night but by day, though at night the disturbances are more of an unpleasant and sometimes a more alarming character. The poor old woman who died in it 3 weeks ago was a pauper whom I took out of a workhouse, for in her childhood she had been known to some of my family, and had once been in such good circumstance that she had rented that house of my uncle. She was a woman of superior education and strong mind, and was the only person I could ever induce to remain in the house. Indeed, since her death, I have so despaired of finding any person to take charge of the house, much more a tenant that would willingly let it or rent it for a year to anyone who would pay its rates and taxes. How long is it since the house acquired this sinister character? The old woman I spoke of said it was haunted when she rented it between 30 and 40 years ago. She was empowered to let the house in apartments. I never had one lodger who stayed more than 3 days. I do not tell you their stories. To no two lodgers have there been exactly the same phenomena repeated. It is better that you judge for yourself than enter the house with an imagination influenced by previous narratives. Only be prepared to see and hear something or other, and take whatever precautions you yourself please. Have you ever had a curiosity yourself to pass the night in the house? Yes, I passed not a night, but 3 hours in broad daylight alone in that house. My curiosity is not satisfied, but it is quenched. I have no desire to renew the experiment, and unless your interest be exceedingly eager, and your nerves unusually strong, I honestly add that I advise you not to pass the night in that house. Mr. J. said very little more. Impatient for the experiment, as soon as I reached home, I summoned my confidential servant, a young man of gay spirits, fearless temper, and as free-form superstitious prejudice as anyone could think of. F., said I, you remember in Germany how disappointed we were at not finding a ghost in that old castle? Well, I have heard of a house in London which is decidedly haunted. I mean to sleep there tonight. From what I hear, there is no doubt that something will allow itself to be seen or heard, something perhaps excessively horrible. Do you think if I take you with me, I may rely on your perseverance of mind, whatever may happen? Oh, sir, pray trust me, answered F., grinning with delight. Very well. Go now. Make up a good fire, air the bed well. See, of course, that there are candles as well as fuel. Take with you my revolver and my dagger. Arm yourself equally well. I was engaged for the rest of the day. Accordingly, about 9:30, I strolled leisurely toward the haunted house. I took with me a favorite dog, a dog fond of prowling about strange, ghostly corners and passages at night. It was a summer night, but chilly, the sky somewhat gloomy and overcast. Still, there was a moon, and if the clouds permitted, after midnight it would be brighter. I reached the house, knocked, and my servant opened with a cheerful smile. All right, sir, and very comfortable. Oh, I said, rather disappointed, have you not seen or heard anything remarkable? Well, sir, I must own that I have heard something queer. What, what? The sound of feet pattering behind me, and once or twice small noises like whispers close at my ear. Nothing more. You are not at all frightened? Aye, not a bit of it, sir. And the man's bold look reassured me on one point, namely that he would not desert me. We were in the hall, the street door closed, and my attention was now drawn to my dog. He had at first run in eagerly enough, but had sneaked back to the door and was scratching and whining to get out. After patting him on the head and encouraging him gently, the dog seemed to reconcile himself to the situation and followed me and F. through the house, but keeping close at my heels instead of hurrying inquisitively in advance. We first visited the subterranean apartments, the kitchen and other offices, and the cellars. There was a gloomy little backyard with very high walls. The stones of this yard were very damp. And what with the damp and what with the dust and smoke grime on the pavement, our feet left little light impressions where we passed. And now appeared the first strange phenomenon witnessed by myself in this strange abode. I saw just before me the print of a foot suddenly form itself, as it were. I stopped, caught hold of my servant, and pointed to it. In advance of that footprint, as suddenly dropped another. We both saw it. I advanced quickly to the place the footprint kept advancing before me, a small footprint, the foot of a child. The impression was too faint thoroughly to distinguish the shape, but it seemed to both of us that it was the print of a naked foot. The phenomenon ceased when we arrived at the opposite wall, nor did it repeat itself on returning. We entered the rooms on the ground floor, all still as death. We then visited the drawing rooms, which seemed fresh and new. In the front room, I seated myself in an armchair. F placed on the table the candlestick with which he had lighted us. I told him to shut the door, and as he turned to do so, a chair opposite to me moved from the wall quickly and noiselessly, and dropped itself about a yard from my own chair immediately fronting it. "Why, this is better than the turning tables," said I with a half laugh, and as I laughed, my dog put back his head and howled. F, coming back, employed himself in stilling the dog. I continued to gaze on the chair and fancied I saw on it a pale blue misty outline of a human figure, but an outline so indistinct that I could only distrust my own vision. The dog now was quiet. "Put back that chair opposite to me," I said to F. "Put it back to the wall." F obeyed. "Was that you, sir?" he said, turning abruptly. "Aye, what?" "Why, something struck me. I felt it sharply on the shoulder, just here." "No," said I. We did not stay long in the drawing rooms. In fact, they felt so damp and so chilly that I was glad to get to the fire upstairs. We locked the doors of the drawing rooms, a precaution which we had taken with all the rooms we had searched below. The bedroom my servant had selected for me was the best on the floor, a large one with two windows fronting the street. The four-posted bed was opposite to the fire. A door in the wall to the left between the bed and the window communicated with the room which my servant appropriated to himself. The last was a small room with a sofa bed and had no communication with the landing place, no other door but that which conducted to the bedroom I was to occupy. On either side of the fireplace was a cupboard without locks, flush with the wall, and covered with the same dull brown paper. We examined these cupboards, only hooks to suspend female dresses, nothing else. The walls, evidently solid, the outer walls of the building, having finished the survey of these apartments, warmed myself a few moments and lighted my cigar. I then, still accompanied by F, went forth to complete my reconnoitre. In the landing place there was another door. It was closed firmly. "Sir," said my servant in surprise, "I unlocked this door with all the others when first I came. It cannot have got locked from the inside, for—" Before he had finished his sentence, the door, which neither of us then was touching, opened quietly of itself. We looked at each other a single instant. The same thought seized both. Some human agency might be detected here. I rushed in first. My servant followed. A small, blank, dreary room, without furniture, a few empty boxes and hampers in a corner, a small window, the shutters closed, not even a fireplace, no other door but that by which we had entered, no carpet on the floor, and the floor seemed very old, but no living being. As we stood gazing round, the door by which we had entered closed. We were imprisoned. For the first time, I felt a creep of undefinable horror. "Not so, my servant." "Why, they don't think to trap us, sir. I could break that door with a kick of my foot." "Try first if it will open to your hand," said I, shaking off the vague apprehension that had seized me, "while I unclose the shutters and see what is without." The window looked on the little backyard. No man getting out of that window would have found any footing till he had fallen on the stones below. F, meanwhile, was vainly attempting to open the door. He now turned round to me and asked my permission to use force, and I should here state that his nerve, composure, and even gaiety amidst circumstances so extraordinary compelled my admiration. He was a companion in every way fitted to the occasion. I willingly gave him the permission he required, but the door did not even shake. Breathless and panting, he desisted. I then tried the door myself, equally in vain. As I ceased from the effort, again that creep of horror came over me. But this time it was more cold and stubborn. I felt as if some strange and ghastly exhalation were rising up from the chinks of that rugged floor and filling the atmosphere with a venomous influence hostile to human life. The door now very slowly and quietly opened as if of its own accord. We precipitated ourselves into the landing place. We both saw a large pale light, as large as a human figure, but shapeless and unsubstantial, move before us and ascend the stairs that led from the landing into the attics. I followed the light, and my servant followed me. It entered to the right of the landing, a small garret, of which the door stood open. I entered in the same instant. The light then collapsed into a small globule, exceedingly brilliant and vivid, rested a moment on a bed in the corner, quivered, and vanished. We approached the bed and examined it, a half-tester such as commonly found in attics devoted to servants. Probably it had belonged to the old woman, who had last died in the house. I had sufficient curiosity to open the drawers. There were a few odds and ends, and two letters tied round with a narrow ribbon of faded yellow. I took the liberty to possess myself of the letters. We distinctly heard, as we turned to go, the pattering footfall on the floor just before us. I had the letters in my hand. Just as I was descending the stairs, I distinctly felt my wrist seized, and a faint, soft effort made to draw the letters from my clasp. I only held them more tightly, and the effort ceased. We regained the bedchamber appropriated to myself, and I then remarked that my dog had not followed us when we had left it. He was thrusting himself close to the fire and trembling. I was impatient to examine the letters, and while I read them, my servant opened a little box in which he had deposited the weapons I had ordered him to bring, took them out, and placed them on the table close to my bedhead, and then occupied himself in soothing the dog, who had seemed to heed him very little. The letters were short, the dates exactly 35 years ago. They were evidently from a lover to his mistress. A distinct reference to a former voyage indicated the writer to have been a seafarer. The spelling and handwriting were those of a man imperfectly educated, but still forcible. In the expressions of endearment there was a kind of rough, wild love, but here and there were dark, unintelligible hints of some secret that seemed of crime. "Don't let anyone be in the same room with you at night. You talk in your sleep." And again, "What's done can't be undone, and I tell you there's nothing against us unless the dead could come to life." Here there was underlined in a better handwriting, "They do." At the end of the letter, the same hand had written these words, "Lost at sea, the 4th of June, the same day as..." I put down the letters and began to muse over their contents. Fearing, however, that the train of thought into which I fell might unsteady my nerves, I laid the letters on the table, stirred up the fire, and opened my volume of Macaulay. I read quietly enough till about 11:30. I then told my servant he might retire to his own room, but bade him leave open the door between the two rooms. Thus alone, I kept two candles burning on the table by my bedhead. I placed my watch beside the weapons and calmly resumed my Macaulay. Opposite to me, on the hearthrug, seemingly asleep, lay the dog. Then I felt an exceedingly cold air pass by my cheek like a sudden drought. I then turned my glance to the left and saw the flame of the candles violently swayed as by a wind. At the same moment, the watch beside the revolver softly slid from the table. I sprang up, seizing the revolver with the one hand and the dagger with the other. I was not willing that my weapons should share the same fate of the watch. Thus armed, I looked round the floor and no sign of the watch. Three slow, loud, distinct knocks were heard at the bedhead. My servant called out, "Is that you, sir?" "No, be on your guard." The dog now roused himself and sat on his haunches, his ears moving quickly back and forwards. He kept his eyes fixed on me with a look so strange. Slowly he rose up, all of his hair bristling, and stood perfectly rigid. Presently my servant emerged from his room, and if ever I saw horror in the human face, it was then. I should not have recognized him had we met in the street. He passed by me quickly, saying in a whisper that seemed scarcely to come from his lips, "Run, run, it's after me." He gained the door to the landing, pulled it open, and rushed forth. I followed him into the landing, involuntarily calling him to stop, but without heeding me, he bounded down the stairs, clinging to the balusters and taking several steps at a time. I heard where I stood the street door open, heard it again clap to. I was left alone in the haunted house. Pride and curiosity alike forbade so dastardly a flight. I re-entered my room, closing the door after me, and proceeded cautiously into the interior chamber. I encountered nothing to justify my servant's terror. I returned to my room and shut and locked the door that opened upon the interior one, and stood on the hearth expectant and prepared. I now perceived that the dog had slunk into an angle of the wall and was pressing himself close against it, as if literally striving to force his way into it. I approached the animal and spoke to it. The poor brute was evidently beside itself with terror. I left him alone, placed my weapons on the table beside the fire, separated myself, and recommenced my macaulay. I now became aware that something interposed between the page and the light. The page was overshadowed. I looked up and saw what I find very difficult to observe. It was a darkness, shaping itself in very undefined outline. I cannot say it was of a human form, and yet it had more resemblance to a human form, or rather shadow, than to anything else. It seemed gigantic, the summit nearly touching the ceiling. When I gazed, a feeling of intense cold seized me. As I continued to gaze, I thought that I distinguished two eyes looking down on me from the height. I strove to speak, my voice utterly failed me. I could only think to myself, "Is this fear?" "It is not fear." I strove to rise in vain. I felt as if weighed down by an irresistible force. And now came horror, to a degree that no words can convey. My reason rejects this thing. It is an illusion. And now the light began to slowly wane from the candles. They were not extinguished, but it was the same with the fire. In a few minutes, the room was in utter darkness. The dread that came over me brought a reaction of nerve that either my senses must have deserted me, or I must have burst through the spell. I found voice. "I do not fear. My soul does not fear." And at the same time, I found strength to rise. Still in that profound gloom, I rushed to one of the windows, tore aside the curtain. My first thought was light. And when I saw the moon, I felt joy. I turned to look back into the room. The moon penetrated its shadow very palely and partially, but still there was light. The dark thing was gone. My eye now rested on the table, and from under there rose a hand. Visible as far as the wrist, it was a hand seemingly as much of flesh and blood as my own, but the hand of an aged person lean, wrinkled, small, a woman's hand. That hand very softly closed on the two letters that lay on the table. Both vanished. There then came the same three loud, measured knocks I had heard at the bedhead before the extraordinary drama had commenced. A chair was now advanced from the wall without apparent agency. Suddenly, there grew a woman's shape. It was distinctly and ghastly as death. The face was that of a youth, with a strange, mournful beauty. Its eyes were turned toward the door, as if from the door, though it did not open, there grew out another shape, equally distant, equally ghastly, a young man's shape. It was in the dress of the last century, with its ruffles and lace and buckles. There was a blood stain on the breast of the female, and the phantom male was leaning on its phantom sword. Then they were gone. Nothing now was left but the shadow, and on that my eyes were intently fixed, till again eyes grew out of the shadow, malignant serpent eyes. Once I felt the clutch as of cold, soft fingers at my throat. I was still equally conscious that if I gave way to fear, I should be in bodily peril. And I concentred all of my faculties in the single focus of resisting. I turned my sight from the shadow, above all from those strange serpent eyes. The pale atmosphere in the room began now to redden. Again were heard the three measured knocks. And then all things were swallowed up in the darkness of the dark shadow. As the gloom receded, the shadow was wholly gone. Slowly the flame grew again into the candles. The whole room came once more into sight. The two doors were still closed. In the corner of the wall lay the dog. Another surprising circumstance, my watch was restored to the table from which it had been so mysteriously withdrawn. But it had stopped at the very moment it was so withdrawn. Nor, despite all the skill of the watchmaker, has it ever gone since. In the morning, I gained my own home, expecting to find my runaway servant there. But he had not presented himself, nor did I hear more of him for 3 days. When I received a letter from him, dated from Liverpool, to this effect. Honored sir, I humbly entreat your pardon. I am going to my brother-in-law at Melbourne. The ship sails tomorrow. I do nothing now but start and tremble, and fancy it is behind me. The letter ended with additional apologies. I returned in the evening to the house to bring away the things I had left there. In this task, I was not disturbed. On leaving the house, I went to Mr. J's, and was about to relate quickly what had passed when he stopped me and said that he had no longer any interest in the mystery which none had ever solved. I will tell you what I would do. I am convinced from my own internal feelings that the small unfurnished room forms a starting point for the influences which haunt the house, and I strongly advise you to have the whole room pulled down. I observe that it is detached from the body of the house and could be removed without injury to the rest of the building. The day was accordingly fixed. Under the rafters, covered with rubbish, was found a trap door. We descended into the room below. In this room there had been a window and a flue, but they had been bricked over. By the help of candles, we examined this place. It still retained some molding furniture, but our main discovery was in a kind of iron safe fixed to the wall. In the safe were 3 shelves and 2 small drawers. Ranged on the shelves were several small bottles of crystal, hermetically stopped. Phosphor and ammonia entered into some of them. There were also some very curious glass tubes and a small pointed rod of iron with a lump of rock crystal and another of amber also a lodestone of great power. In one of the drawers, we found a miniature portrait set in gold of a man who might be somewhat advanced in middle life, perhaps 47 or 48. It was a remarkable face. If you could fancy some mighty serpent transformed into a man. Mechanically, I turned round the miniature to examine the back of it, and on the back was engraved a pentacle. In the middle of the pentacle, a ladder. And the third step of the ladder was formed by the date 1765. Examining still, more minutely, I detected a spring. This, on being pressed, opened the back of the miniature as a lid. Within side the lid were engraved, "Mariana, to thee, be faithful in life and in death." Upon a small, thin book, or rather tablet, was placed a saucer of crystal. I opened the tablet. It contained but one sheet of thick vellum, and on that sheet were inscribed, within a double pentacle, words in old monkish Latin, which were literally to be translated thus: "On all that it can reach, within these walls, sentient or inanimate, living or dead, so work my will. Accursed be the house, and restless be the dwellers therein." We found no more. This has been Nightfall Narratives with Oxford Public Library. We hope you enjoyed these strange and unusual stories. We will see you again soon. Goodbye for now.